You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the show is Stuart Lyle, Urban Operations Research Lead for the UK-based Defense Science and Technology Laboratory, DSTL. Stuart, of course, if you've ever listened to the show, is a repeat offender, along with he is one part of our trio, me, Stuart, and our friend Jason Giroux of the Canadian descent, who isn't with us today. Usually Jason will tell you how many times he's been on the show. I don't know if that's what Stuart plans to do, but he's a repeat offender, and I'm really looking forward to the conversation. Stu, welcome back.
Thank you very much, John. It's great to be back.
Okay, so I thought we'd have, based on some things that you and Jason actually did and some conversations we've been having on X and then ourselves, one is that I know that you and Jason attended the NATO Special Environment Panel Urban Operations. I wasn't able to attend, but I saw the slides and the presentations. It looked like great things. I was hoping that you could give us an update of what it is and how it went.
Yeah, it was a fascinating event. The purpose of it, it's sponsored by NATO Land Command, and the purpose of it is to get all of the doctrine writers and those involved in informing the doctrine for all of those different specific environments, so whether it be jungle, mountain, Arctic, or urban, and get them all together, and we'll break up into different environmental teams, and they'll discuss next steps on the rotation for doctrine, who's going to write what next, and what sort of thing are they going to include, any changes that might need to be made based on research over the last however many years since the last update. So that's the purpose of those events. This event was hosted by the Dutch. It was the Netherlands Army that were hosting it, and they have previously been the leads for the urban doctrine for NATO. So that was the primary focus of this specific event. And that's where I came in. So I was brought in as a subject matter expert to effectively come in and give a series of briefs to the doctrine writers to cover off some of those slightly more niche areas that maybe they haven't really looked into before, and that might help shape some of the thinking about what they might include in the next iteration of NATO Urban Tactics Doctrine. So that's what we were discussing, and then there was a whole series of workshops thinking about who's going to lead on what sections, who's going to inform various iterations. Has there any research that has been done recently that can then get shared amongst the doctrine writers? And it's one of the things that's kind of how the sausage is made. The doctrine writers aren't necessarily experts in those particular environments that they get posted to. You get posted to, like most people in the military, you get posted to a given job, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you are an expert in that job. And so these people arrive and they're told the next one on this calendar is you're going to update the urban doctrine. And people have to then kind of get up to speed on it and then be responsible for writing it. So so sometimes the doctrine leads are not necessarily experts in it. So that's why we work collaboratively to try and help each other out.
Yeah, I would say not sometimes, Stu. I can be the critical. I'll say all the time. I'm having participated in multiple updates of the U.S. military's urban doctrine, and always very happy to help, but get, you know, the person that reaches out is somebody who's been assigned to the desk, usually a rotating officer. There is no one active duty or civilian assigned to the U.S. military who is the kind of wealth of knowledge, the expert. I know that having you, what I would dub as the UK British Army, UK writ large, Department of the Ministry of Defense expert on urban operations. So I'm sure you being in the room is something very special, but the same thing with Jason, who is the Canadian expert with just over a decade of doctrine reviews. And I know that Jason digs deep into like Russian doctrine, NATO doctrine, US doctrine. I've been a part of the SEP before as well. I think it was, I'd be dating myself, one of the ones that we did in Los Angeles before even the creating the Urban Operations Planners course, and I presented on Mumbai, but the panel was held in the US. So this one was held and the Dutch led it, but I know that offshoot, there was a couple of day trips, right? Like they do when they hold these things to get all those doctrine writers out of those rooms, get some fresh air. And I saw some of your pictures, and actually what I think this conversation will be more about is the variety. Really, I think we'll tour the world of urban operations training centers, because you do have the doctrine, but you, of course, you need realistic training to implement, train, man, equip, experiment, all of that we talk about a lot on the show, and you and I have talked about for years. I know you're, you know, with the research and development in depth and years of seeing people do it and how you do it, not just taking lessons, like you said, from the modern battlefield, again, what we do, but also experimenting with it, and you need sites for that. During this NATO SEP, you guys took a day trip to the Dutch Urban Training Estate, I think they call it. What did you see?
Yeah, so this was really surprising, because we knew that we were going to be visiting these the two main urban training areas that they've got, one called Convoy and the other one called Oostorp. And the person who was hosting, the lead host, was a Dutch Lieutenant Colonel, Ron. And he's been in that post for nearly 6 years now, leading the urban tactics platoon. And within that time frame, he's been slowly adapting these urban training areas. So I'd known about a couple of these sites. I'd met some of the Dutch warrant officers who run the sites. I'd met them a couple of years before, and they've been explaining about the different areas and what they can and can't do. And this was back in 2023. And getting to see them then in 2026, the changes from what I'd previously been told and what they were doing now was quite dramatic and really impressive. So I'll just briefly talk about the two that we went to see. So the first one, Convoy, it's a very it's a small training area. There's only really a handful of buildings. So there's two skills houses with movable walls. One of them has that overhead gantry that allows instructing staff and other students to observe in order to be able to sort of build up those low-level individual and team CQB skills. So they had elements where they could integrate or represent explosive breaching, even though they couldn't necessarily use explosives, but they could represent the effect and then sort of demonstrate how you could integrate a little bit of combined arms with the assault engineers to do that sort of thing. They then also have an old Cold War underground bunker. It's an old command and control center. It looks like something out of, you know, so, the movie War Game, if you've ever seen it. You know, so the underground facility with all the banks of computers. But it was literally underwater. It had filled up with water for a good 5 years. So they had to drain that out, and then they could use it as an urban training area. So if you could imagine a building that is just a manifestation of tetanus, is kind of that's what this place looked like. And so they cleaned it out. They'd made it safe for humans to actually go into it. But the floors were completely rotten, and they'd made gangways and stuff. And we were sort of walking around thinking, you know, so there's no way we would get the sign off to do this in the UK. And the Dutch attitude was, yeah, but this is what urban training areas are. This is what urban battle sites tend to look like. The buildings don't tend to have nice flat floors. There's always trip hazards. So they've just taken risk with it and said, yeah, carry on, which was quite impressive to see. And then because it's two stories underground, a little bit more than sort of the standard two stories, they use it for training things like subterranean command and control, vertical CASIVAC, going upwards against gravity this time, and some of that coordination for low light or no light training. And that facility there is used predominantly by Dutch Special Operations Forces. That's where they spend most of their time. And there was a few of the Rangers were there at the time doing some training while we were there. So that was the first site. Great little facility, and they were using it quite well, really making the most of what was available to them, and there are plans to expand it, which is good. Then the second site, Oostorp, this was the main training area and was the main urban training site, and is within one of the larger training areas available to the Dutch Army. Most of the buildings had been there from about the 1990s. There were a few that were older from the 1960s, I believe. But there's about 24 buildings, so it's not a huge facility. But what they've managed to do with it was genuinely impressive and sort of took most of us by surprise, who have had experience with other urban training areas. So one of the buildings was a large sort of tin shed with a CQB facility inside. So again, movable walls, overhead gantry for doing CQB. That was cleared for blank and simulation, and they had a bunch of paintball guns that they could use for doing force on force. And some of these were the paintball guns they got were ones that were very realistically representing the same. Basically, it's the same thing as the standard issue rifle. So it's an M4 type rifle system, and that way they could have people mount their own optics, their own accessories onto it. They were loaded up with 30 rounds with paintball rounds. And again, trying to minimize the amount of altering to suit the training need, which was great. The next building that took us to was something I've never seen before in any other urban training areas, and it was a live fire shoot house on the edge of the urban training area, but it wasn't for shooting at targets inside the buildings. What it was set up for was to do live fire from inside, shooting out of the building, so giving people the experience of shooting from inside prepared defensive positions, or shooting from standing but out of the building. So they had this two-story building, looked like any of the other buildings in the training area, but it overlooked a 600 meter live fire range that extended beyond the training village, which was fantastic. Some of the rooms have been set up with, you know, the sandbagged machine gun position, as if you were defending the building, so set back inside the room with overhead protection and everything. And the real key thing, the thing that really stood out to us here, is that one of the things that a lot of troops don't get exposure to is the experience of firing live rounds, especially burst fire, inside a confined space. Most CQB facilities don't have a roof, so even if you do get into a live fire CQB facility, you're still not getting that same effect of firing live rounds inside that enclosed space. And if you've ever done it, it's quite it is quite an experience, and it does have an effect on troops. There's a cognitive effect that it has through that overpressure, especially if it's repeated in quick succession. So exposing troops to that, genuinely excellent experience. And then you can move from that, step outside. They have a drill where basically, you know, you kind of clear yourself of live rounds, swap out for blanks, and then you can then progress into an assault into the next buildings using blank rounds. Next to that, there was a shotgun breaching range. And then they took us down to these new additions that they'd added in the last couple of years. So they built a whole series of trench systems that were on the urban fringe. So moving out from between several buildings and then extending out in a line in front of the urban training area. There was trench systems with overhead cover, with chicanes, anti-drone nets, and chicken wire to stop hand grenades and drones. They had an anti-armor ditch to stop vehicle access, and then they had another series of bunkers and tunnels in front of that. And the idea behind that is to then teach people the step-by-step process for doing that breach, that complex breaching operation into an urban area. So not just, you know, so you get into the urban area because nobody's defending outside of it. It's actually trying to show, like, this is what it would actually be if somebody had really kind of put some time and effort into it, which they have. So that was fantastic to see. There was even a mortar pit in there. So if you were then trying to assault the village and you were trying to do your ISTAR feed, you're trying to find out where that mortar pit's coming from, where that mortar fire might be coming from. So they really thought about it. The officer who was in charge of that was a lieutenant, but he'd previously been a warrant officer for a lot of years. And he'd been there for coming up on 4 years now, and had been there just slowly adding more and more to the facility as he could. There was a subterranean aspect to it. So there was a sewer system that ran in a loop around underneath the whole urban training area with multiple access points. You know, so your manhole covers that people could access to either go down or to have to be aware of and provide security for. And then there was a larger entrance where you could get access to that was then hidden. So again, trying to teach people about the ISTAR of how to track and identify these types of things. some of the rest of it was just so your standard buildings, your concrete buildings, like, you know, like everywhere else, mostly based on, you know, German villages, because a lot of these things were planned originally during the later part of the Cold War. But the another thing that stood out as being a fantastic opportunity that I've certainly never seen before was there was one building that had been set aside as the weapon effects building, and they'd taken a series of freestanding walls that were outside of it, and they'd hit them with tank rounds, different types of tank rounds, different types of IFE rounds, shoulder launch Panzerfausts, those sorts of things, to demonstrate to troops, this is what it'll do. This is the size of hole that it's going to make in the wall. So if you're going to use it for breaching, this is the, you know, contextualizing it for them. And then the building itself had then been subjected to a whole series of live fire to again demonstrate what it will actually do. So hitting it with a 40 millimeter HEDP, high explosive dual purpose grenade from an underground grenade launcher. So you can see that actually it didn't even shatter the brick, but it did put a hole the size of your thumb through the brick. Other areas where they'd shot different types of 5.56, both from the assault rifle and from the light machine gun, at double glazed windows, at various brickwork, at door frames, etc. And again, just really kind of allowing the troops to walk through and see these things and go, yeah, okay, actually, I now understand what the difference is between cover and concealment, even though it instinctively feels like cover because it's a brick wall. Actually, things can go through this. It doesn't take a 50 cal to get through a brick wall. And then one of the other rooms had been set up with a series of furniture, like you would, you know, there was a desk and a desk chair and a sofa and a couch, and some chest of drawers and that sort of thing. Just a standard sort of room. And then they detonated a hand grenade in the middle of the room. So you could see the devastation that it would do to the furniture, but then you could also see the fragmentation patterns around the walls itself. So you could see then this is what's actually going to happen when you throw a hand grenade into this room. Phenomenal education piece for the troops that go through there, and something we were very jealous about, and certainly want to try and replicate if we can.
That's all amazing, Stu, and I was actually jealous at some of the photos as well. Of the three things you said that, of course, jumped out to me is the, like you said, that I've never seen a firing range inside of a house extending out 600 meters, like you said, and having done it in combat and probably the cause of some of my hearing loss, you're right. If you haven't experienced it, then we're not training for realism. The weapons effects building, you and I have talked over the years about needing to replicate that, just soldiers knowing the effects of their weapons. And you have, I know, whole presentations on that. The myth of what they think their weapon's going to do, what it's not going to do. Mm-hmm. I myself, in 2003, my soldiers shooting an AT-4 at a wall. And since it's a Sabo type of munition, just putting a small little hole in the wall didn't do nothing. Also, the photo of the realistically furnished room, which some places try to replicate, but then having the battle effects on that room, I found fascinating. What was the scale? Because I know sometimes, like, I'm sure we'll get it to, like, Copil Downs, the rubbleized street, mm-hmm. It looks really good in photos until you realize it's about, you know, 100 meters of street. What was the scale of these sites and these different features of that?
Yeah, they were still small. Convoy was particularly small. They'd taken buildings that had previously been one of them was a cookhouse, and one was an old officer's accommodation block. And then there was the bunker. So they were just kind of there within a stone's throw of each other. So there was no real sort of scale to it. But what they'd done with what they had, and the exploitation of the subterranean was really good. The Oostorp facility, you were only really talking about 24 buildings. So it's not big. And even while they'd put in all the effort to put the trench systems and the forward defensive positions, training safe razor wire, that was something they'd use a lot. So yeah, razor wire, but without the razors. But you kind of simulate the fact that people are still going to have to deal with it. and those sorts of things were they'd obviously put a lot of effort into that, but there was almost no rubble actually in the village itself. So there was kind of this mix mash between somebody who had prepped the building or prepped the village for serious defense, but then there was no battle effects actually inside the village itself for any pre-bombardment that had taken place and that sort of thing. So even there, it wasn't a huge lot of complexity to it, and scale wise it was still pretty small, but still impressive what they had done. But yeah, the scale was still it wasn't actually one of the things that they were quite keen to say was that the Dutch infantry are more keen to go to Germany to use the German facility than to use their own facility, even though we were all walking around saying, "This is fantastic. We'd love to copy this."
So what size formation would you say would be training on that facility and not bumping into each other?
I think you would probably be able to, at most, if you had the full village to yourself, then you're really talking about a company group, combined arms company group. But that would be pretty tight.
Yeah, that's not too shabby. Okay, as a connoisseur of urban training facilities around the world, that was really useful for you to send that report back, and that we talk about it. But I think what I wanted to spend the rest of the time, which is really this, let's talk about it. Let's talk about these challenges. Like you said, they've done some amazing work to integrate realism into an urban training site. Having worked in that space since 2014, of course, having my own experiences with urban training facilities, them deploying the combat and realizing the lack of realism, depending on the context, the mission, environment, all of these things. I wanted to do a little bit of time just doing a survey of the world's training facilities, as I think all militaries of the world struggle with these two aspects of preparing for urban warfare. Of course, if you listen to the show, it's not the future, it's the present. I could argue it's the past, it's a decisive battle, all of that. But you got to prepare for it. You know, you not just train, man, and equip. In order to train for it, you have to have the facilities. Been dealing with that, written about that for years. There's always the scale aspect, but there's actually two aspects of this: scale and realism. And what also sparked this conversation, not just your trip and the excellent work that you and Jason did during the trip, I think getting to see a new site, but you also posted, because some of these things surface every once in a while, whether it's World War II training videos, and I think you posted one, a Cold War video of some training at an urban warfare training site, maybe you know where, but just the immense amounts of rubble, complexity of the buildings, fires, truly training, like maneuvering through the space, fighting through the space. You want to highlight a little bit about that video that you posted, and that'll lead into our kind of, okay, what's out there right now?
Yeah, that video was of a Cold War, late Cold War, so 1980s German Bundeswehr infantry clearing through quite a complex facility with multiple buildings, multi-layer buildings. The buildings themselves had significant amount of damage applied to them, so there was a lot of rubble in the street in between. But even inside the building, sometimes walls were missing, external as well. So you had to, as you were clearing through, you had to be conscious that as you pass through an area where the wall is missing, you're now exposed to observation and fire from potentially outside the building. They had fires going off inside the building, so again, adding that layer of kind of atmospherics and chaos. Some of the floors were missing as well, so there's that risk element of going into a room and there's literally a hole in the floor, but then also thinking, well, actually there could be somebody down there that you have to go and deal with, so you're having to clear vertically at the same time. So that video was put out as part of a German army training video series. We've seen militaries put together videos to try and contextualize some of the doctrine and some of the TTPs, the tactics that they like to try and teach. And they'll put it in a video to kind of contextualize it and then be able to use that as a kind of opener for people running on a training exercise. And so this was the German version of it. I believe that facility was actually a one-off. They'd been given an old industrial unit that was going to be demolished. So they decided, well, let's just, you know, knock out a whole load of stuff to make it look like it had already been subjected to some fires. And then they were going to then run through and show them how they would assault and clear it and, you know, get rid of the Soviets. So that's the origin of that video and the sort of the nature of that training area they were using.
Yeah, because as a soldier who has trained in multiple U.S. German urban training sites, that site doesn't exist anymore, which is interesting, right? It's 1980s. Where'd it go? Great for the context of it was a one-off. But us urban warfare experts are like, that, yes, that's what we need. That's what we need. And the realism and having worked with more than one military, even Israel's national training site, Sehelim, although they've recently made a lot of adaptations too. You mentioned that one aspect of walls missing, even facades missing. And Jason, if he was here, would, you know, in Ortona, in any of these World War II battles, but the realism is just not there. But, you know, dropping the facades of buildings, and actually one of the things I saw in Gaza, buildings with facades dropped, and it creates this weird kind of, you know, you can see five levels of a building, but if you're on one side of the building, and is what the Germans did while knowing the Canadians were approaching, they dropped the facades on one building and they were set up in the other building to create an ambush. So in Gaza, I saw almost the exact same thing, but that's a little bit of an aside, but it is one of those features of, you know, how everybody tries to add these features. Mm-hmm. I thought I'd spend a couple minutes, since that video is kind of the spark to almost an evergreen conversation about, we don't have the urban training sites to prepare for the reality of urban, high intensity urban warfare. Yes, everybody has a shoot house where they can train their very specific tactics of enter and clear a room, multi-floor buildings, but that's not necessarily preparing for high intensity urban combat with the realism of rubblized terrain, complexity, all of these things that we're talking about. I'll start us off with the U.S. military best urban training sites we have. And then I'd love to hear some of the ones in Europe. I've been to a lot of them, but I know that you've been to a lot of them as well. So from the U.S. military, we have the National Training Center in Fort Owen, California. Razish, I just did an episode with the commander of the opposing force, which most of these urban training centers also lack, which is a trained urban defender. Because we're always attacking, right? Nobody in NATO is defending, everybody's attacking. But anyways,
somebody would write about that.
Yeah. Number one, NTC or Razish, you know, over 500 buildings. It is the biggest that the U.S. military has. And I was involved in a lot of like the national urban training facility conversation of trying, back in the mega city days, the CSA at the time, the chief of staff of the army, wanted to be able to do a 3-day training event for a brigade in that site. It's the largest we have. Then we have the Marine Corps closely, and we could, they often count buildings. A range 220 that I know you've been to as well at 29 Palms. Next to that is the JRTC, Dar al-Alam, down in Fort Polk, Louisiana, where I once lived. Those are our three, you know, dirt combat training centers. And of course you have JRMT or JMTC in Europe, with the site as well, but those three main ones in the United States are our biggest. And then we have one in the inventory at Miskatatuck Urban Training Facility run by the Indiana National Guard near Camp Atterbury. It's actually in Seymour, Indiana. It is the most realistic U.S.-based training center we have, but it doesn't have the scale of the NTC or Range 220. And there's differences. And then we have, of course, at all of our major installations, there'll be some type of urban training, whether that's Fort Bragg, Fort Benning, Lewis McChord, and many other ones, whether it's a true, what we call CACTIF, Combined Arms Company Training Facility, probably wrong there, and they probably changed the name anyways. But these home station urban training sites that have evolved from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and many of them advanced century, all of this stuff. And then there's one at AP Hill, Stu, that was on the late rest in peace, asymmetric warfare group site that has like glass buildings, elevators, sewers, everything. Actually, the Musketatuck Training Center has the most extensive underground because it used to be a mental home place where they sent the mentally patients. And so it's a full, real, like mini city-ish thing with a mile of underground. It's a really impressive site. Just the scale isn't right. So
we also have some partially damaged buildings there as well, which is constructed to look partially damaged and things.
Yeah. And I've had, if you go back, I think I have one of the chief trainers there. Cause they do a lot of humanitarian assistance, disaster relief training there with the whole of government. So they have buildings that they actually can collapse and rise up, and very impressive. Their urban canyon. Again, if we're realistic, the scale of it, be hard pressed beyond a platoon and a company, let's say. And they've done some, that's where they did the Marine Corps, which they closed, which is a separate conversation, the Project Metropolis 2 experimentation. And they were out at Musketatuck a few years, now more than a few years ago. Just all that to say, that's kind of the rough inventory of the larger ones, because scale matters. But what they all are challenged to, and this is John Spencer's opinion, is the realism. While some of them will have individual features, Stu, like they'll have one 5-story building. Mm-hmm. They'll have one tunnel that connects a couple buildings. What they won't have culturally, actually, is the realism of a true combat environment of rubbleized terrain throughout, the effects of combat, the realism of people actually living in the space, the post-bombardment aspects, because every one of these sites is managed within our training management system as a range in some way, and it has to be cleaned up. You can't have a dirty site. Actually, it was the TRADOC commander who had returned from Mosul, from the Battle of Mosul in 2016 through 17, General Scott Miller, who said, if anything I've taken from commanding this fight is that we don't have the training environments to prepare for it. They need to be dirty. They need to be left dirty, rubbleized. You can't just walk through, drive through them. It was actually him who came back, and I remember that. It didn't happen because you'd have to force culture and the range, not police, but the range mentality of having a, clean it up. Even at NTC, where we have done a lot of work, Jason, especially during the Urban Operations Training Center, trying to get them to, discuss rubbles, strong points, all of that stuff. And they have, some big rocks that they'll pull out into the way of the streets. And then they have to, of course, move those rocks back. I know a little bit about some of the other sites in Europe, but what you explained in the Dutch system, you're right. I don't see that in anywhere across the U.S. military's inventory of training facilities. I've been very vocal that we don't have a single site that can replicate the true large-scale combat operations, even if you were to scale it down in our inventory in this realism. Let's just forget scale, just the realism of a high-intensity urban combat from all of my visits all around the combat zones of the world. We don't have anything. And I'd be interested in what you think going through some of those major European sites.
Yeah, I think, and before moving on, the US sites as well, while I understand why they have them where they have them, and you've got that wide open desert that you can do the brigade level maneuver through. I remember standing up on the top of the sort of quote-unquote embassy building in Rosice and having to ask somebody from the Black Horse to tell me how far away the next nearest terrain feature is, because it was such a moonscape, it was such a billiard table, that there was no point of reference for judging distance. We were all guessing how far away this mound was, and we were all way off.
That's right. It's the random nodal city in the middle of the desert.
Yes, and as a result then, because we're Western militaries, we're always on the offense, it means that you're having to effectively cross that sort of World War One style no man's land, this complete moonscape against the defenders, and it makes it like you say, it's not necessarily that realistic about, you know, how close you can actually approach and being able to maneuver using the terrain to kind of get close and that sort of thing.
But Stu, everything in war, you just fast forward and you're already in the urban terrain. You didn't have to go through urban terrain to get there. You're just there.
So I've been told. So yeah, in terms of the European sites, I can talk quite authoritatively about the about Coupil Down. That's the largest site within the UK. It was built in the 1980s to represent a German village. That was the main priority there was training British light roll infantry to be able to defend those German villages, those kind of noodle points where the ground lines of communication would come through, but also using things like long-range anti-tank guided missiles to be able to reach out and to attrit Soviet armor that was then trying to invade West Germany, or to call in artillery from it and impose those delaying actions in the actual village itself. That was where that sort of design came from. So as much as we lament the fact that Western militaries only ever train for the offense, the principal urban training areas that we have that are legacies of the Cold War were originally designed to teach urban defense, which is fantastic. It's about 90-ish buildings. We have adapted it over the years. So it's gone from being a West German village to suddenly we put in a whole series of walls to make it look a bit more like an Iraqi compound street with multi-story buildings behind those sort of 7 or 8 foot high walls. But it's got an awful lot of good features to it. There's pre-designated explosive breach points, which we can then fit plywood boards into, so you can actually do explosive breaching into those things. And that's on both the compound walls, but also buildings themselves. The buildings themselves are rated for sort of blank and blank pyrotechnics and simmunition, which we use an awful lot of simmunition in the UK. And so not just the laser engagement systems like MILES, or as we call it, TES, but we can use simmunition as well. So we've got some pretty decent representation there. The buildings themselves can be simulated, although it's very rare that people actually do that because it's a bit of effort to do. And then we've got the rubble. And the rubble's a relatively new addition to it, and it's not to the whole facility, but we've got several streets that have quite extensive rubble added to them. So you can't just drive down them. You've got a chicane. Troops can use that as cover as they're moving down the street around, you know, between the armored vehicles, not conga lining behind the tank, thank you very much, but actually, you know, using the rubble as cover to be able to move around in between the buildings. So and that's pretty good. The problem is it's not particularly big. It's several hundred meters from one side to the next, and as soon as troops have been through it, they kind of know it like the back of their hand. Everybody knows the rubble street. It's called Schruten Street, and everybody knows it. Now you can say that that's a good thing or a bad thing. The way I had one of the instructors at our infantry battle school explain it to me is that while yes, they all know Schruten Street like the back of their hand, he said that one of the things that he took away from his career looking back was that the first time he went down it, he was a rifleman private in the infantry. The next time he came through, he was now a machine gunner because it was a year or two later. So he had a different role to play. And then the next time he came through, he was a fire team lead. The next time he was a section commander. So again, so every time he's gone through it, even though he knows the area, generally speaking, he is doing a different job each time. Now, you could say that's because we don't actually train enough. He doesn't get to do it multiple times a year. But, you know, trying to find some positives here, actually.
That's a stretch.
Given the standard of, even though it's a smaller urban training area, people are getting different experiences each time. So, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing. If we then look at some of the other urban training areas, I've obviously talked about the Dutch one, but we've got the big one is the French, the Sonzoub facility. It's quite a large facility. It's certainly a lot larger than Coupil Down. And they've got a representation of different urban terrain zones there as well. So there's some areas that are light industrial units, some areas that are low-rise residential, some are high-rise residential and inner city core, and they have a small stretch of a motorway or highway with an overpass represented there as well. So it's quite a good facility. We would usually send a company, usually armored infantry or mechanized infantry. We'll send a company over fairly regularly to train with the French and use that facility. And when the troops come back, they're always really glowing about the facility. They've usually had some experience of places like Kopeldine, and they see something on that bigger scale at Senzu, and they come back saying, this was fantastic, why don't we have something like this? when I look at Senzu, yes, I see the scale, and I think that's really impressive from being able to maneuver platoons and companies around. But the representation of different types of urban terrain zones is quite minimal. So because even though it's a larger site, the amount that they can represent low-rise residential or light industrial, they become these kind of little sort of postage stamps, these little facades of these different urban terrain zones. And so you kind of no sooner are you in that urban terrain zone that you're out of it again. So it's not really a fair or decent representation of the complexities of what those UTZs would actually get present to the force. Senzu is also very pristine. It's pretty clean. There's an awful lot of open space in between all of the buildings. No fences or urban clutter to kind of block lines of sight and that sort of thing. So while it's got some scale to it and it has some variety to it, it's not without pros and cons to those things as well. The other big facility in Europe is what most people call Altmark. The German name for it is Schnoggersburg, yep. But that usually is quite difficult for anybody other than Germans to be able to pronounce correctly. So I'll just refer to it as Altmark for now, because it's on the wider Altmark training area. It's a fairly new facility. It's only really been open for the last sort of 4 or 5 years now. But it is at scale. You know, there's about 550 buildings, I believe, is the total number. A lot of them can be instrumented, so you can use the laser engagement systems from armored vehicles to then deliver effects inside the rooms. They also have a couple of quite novel little features to it. So there's a river that runs through it that has been made for the village, so you can and it can be filled or drained with water, so you can have a wet gap if you want to, or you can have a dry gap depending on what your scenario is that you're trying to run or the training you're trying to instill. So novel little feature in there. They have various bridges that are either in place or you can remove them, so you can actually conduct a bridging operation in the urban training area, which again, I've not seen that in other urban training areas. I know there's a bit of a river in the one in Camp Lejeune, but you know, I've not seen anybody try and do an actual bridging operation through it. So
that's, well, there's one at 29 Palms, Stu.
Yes, that's very dry.
It's dry. Yeah, it's in the desert, so there's no water in it. Actually, I was a part of a conversation where at the higher level of the U.S. military, they wanted a water obstacle at Rajesh or in the desert, and like, it's just not practicable, let's just say. But I do give credit for the Marine Corps of building. I mean, what city, major city, is not going to have some type of bridge over some type of water obstacle? I mean, it's just, again, the realism. I give them credit for having a dry riverbed in that facility. Yeah. Go ahead.
And the main training area for the British Army is Salisbury Plain, and it is an area of chalky soil, completely devoid of anything but a tiny little trickle of a river. So we have a river that runs through the center of Salisbury Plain that is treated as a river, and it's marked on the military maps as a river. When you get there, it's kind of just a dry ditch, but it forces people to consider it in their planning, although it doesn't run through Kopeldine or next to it. The other thing the Altmark training area has is a subway representation. So it's not extensive, but they do actually have an underground, a large underground facility that people can actually go into. There's a subway platform and a railway tunnel that actually then goes off a bit of a distance. It's not particularly far, but it allows people to go in there and start to think about some of the considerations of there. People can use it as a headquarters facility or a CASEVAC facility, you know, where they can bring the casualties down and start treating them. In relative safety from, you know, if they're talking about conducting large-scale combat operation type scenarios. And then there's various other smaller subterranean, so there's sort of sewer systems that run underneath various buildings and things as well. So it's got some pretty nifty facilities to it, even though the scale of it is pretty impressive. 550 buildings, a lot of them can be instrumented. The one thing it really lacks, though, is some rubble and some clutter. There's almost no clutter, not even that kind of just general sort of street clutter of, you know, parked cars or sort of lampposts and other kind of, you know, the power junction boxes and all that sort of thing that kind of sit there and clutter up the line of sight down a street. It doesn't really have much of that. The Germans are slightly nervous about anybody putting armored vehicles in there because they don't want any of the buildings being damaged, which for anybody who studied urban operations, that's a bit of a no-no. You really want to kind of get them in there. But I understand the sort of the hesitance about, you know, having the buildings damaged themselves. So yeah, there's pros and cons to it.
I would want so that's a separate conversation, which we've talked about. If we could go through all these training centers and see which one of them allows tracked vehicles, period. Most of the U.S. urban ones, especially at a lot of the home station training, may or may not be equipped for that. I know Muscatatuck is not. And for the longest time, there was and I think I've written about this, or at least podcast about it. Even at NTC, there was an urban legend, pun intended, that you couldn't take armored vehicles into the city for some reason. And, you know, talking to the COG or the commander of the operations group, just, you know, 20 repetitions and never seen one go in because it's not true combined arms maneuver, which is its own. I would want that damage caused safety, of course, which is always... the kind of, but safety, John, aspect of, we will march into the jungle as I did. There are risk in, we can't do live cities, although yes, people do that and we could talk about forever, but our cities, our urban training centers in the Western Alliance are not realistic. I'll just say it. They're not realistic in the scale or realism. You could argue scale. We could just train a smaller force. And like you said, you and I have talked about, of all the even modern battles, whether it's Bakhmut, Kyiv, Severodonetsk, Gaza, or something, you know, just creating an industrial district training area because of how many battles happen there and then what changes in replication, I think would be interesting. I could go on, of course, for a long time, but I wanted to mention a couple of things you talked about. One was and I've seen this at Copil Downs, and there's a few of them at Range 220, but this really gets into your training sites drive your tactics, drives your thinking, drives your culture. I truly believe that. Mm-hmm. So no matter what the doctrine says, if I can't replicate it and I culturally have these ways of doing things and then I reinforce those through the training because I'm driven by the constraints of the training environment, whether that's, why would I, and we saw this in the Cold War video, like, why would I enter a building if I know there's somebody in it? Why would I enter a room if there's somebody shooting out of it? You know, why wouldn't I put fire effects, know the limitations of my weapons, shoot through the door, you know, drop a building? These aspects of the realism of high intensity combat. I just had, of course, Black Horse on from NTC about that ROE cultural things that are there that aren't there, but the training site is also driving you to that. Even the maneuver part, and I think one of the aspects that everybody laughed about on that video of the Cold War was the stick wall climb, which I've never done it. I want to give it a try, but the realism of I'm not going to enter that building through the front door or any door. I'm going to go through a window. You know, if I'm going to go top down and I don't yeah, at least you need to have tried it to know it's possible, which really what you said was the mouse holing and aspects in Copil Downs, which I'll give Range 220 some credit. It had a couple, but they, again, the culture of watching forces use these facilities, the nice open road, no rubble, lots of doors and windows, doesn't drive that actual tactic that is like, you're not going to go through the building or through the door or through the window. And like the Israeli site, which is not one of the topics of this conversation, but where they have, because culturally and tactically they've developed, they know not to do that. So they built all of those holes on the all outside of all exterior and interior rooms, practicing going through the terrain and infestation, what they call it. We still haven't gotten there, can't get people there. Even if I put the hole there, like at Copil Downs, a couple places I saw, Rajesh doesn't have many, but then I'd have to get them to use it and have to create the realism of that. So I actually do believe that the predictability of the site is a major negative. If I have one site that I go back to and it actually, you know, you can add a bunch of stuff to it, but if it's the same buildings on the same street pattern, nice square, you know, very well-designed square grid pattern, there's going to be a lot of training value lost if I'm the attacker. And Black Horse actually said, of course I'm going to know the environment. I hope our enemies know their environment and we're not on our environment. Well, we know our environment. There's going to be amount of intelligence preparation of the operating environment, all of that. And by the predictability of all these sites we just talked about, you do lose a lot of value if anybody's ever been to it before, because even if the weapons effects creates that change in the environment, you could do that. And that's not just, again, like we said, pulling a car you got from the junkyard into the way. It's still the same site. And I think we can't have this conversation without talking about, and not because they're good friends, because I do think it's one of the most innovative solutions to militaries that won't change themselves, is what 4GD has done, even within the aspect of a limited, closed training environment, to be able to create a lot of uncertainty when you enter it. So if 4GD is a facilitator that, one, has, I think, done something that nobody's ever done, which is creating the ability to have enablers that aren't usually replicated, from snipers to air attack teams to mortar and artillery, combining the virtual and the constructive and the live. But even within their physical sites, some of the home station training units, but none of them at this scale, having the ability just to redesign an entire warehouse in the walls so that even if a platoon is going to go practice a very small level training, they're never going to face the same layout. And I think that's really creative, and kudos to them. As we identify the, no matter what any 4-star general or John Spencer or anybody else says, what I can't get people to fix is that these sites are not realistic. They could be. And then of course there's a scale issue, but there could be so much done just to fix the realism and stop the culture of having to have a clean site without any risk involved in even rolling an ankle, because we got to clean it all up afterwards.
Yeah, I think so. Talking about the scale issue, this is one thing that we see an awful lot, because we'll get various British Army units will go over to Sonzoub or Altmark, and they'll see those larger urban training areas, or some of them will go over to the American facilities, places like Range 220 is quite a popular one, or Rajesh. And they come back and they say, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if we had something on this scale? And one of the things that I think is a really useful question to ask is, well, what is it you're trying to achieve through your live training? A lot of the live training is about, especially when you're actually inside the urban area, is company and below. Realistically, kind of it's platoon plus, because you're trying to train things like your infantry armor vehicle and coordination, your ability to call on your enabling assets, you know, bringing where do you position and how do you bring forward your engineers to do breaches or to breach obstacles or breach into buildings? How do you coordinate joint fires? Those sorts of things. And that element, you can do that on a relatively small urban training area. Like I say, you could do platoon, you could do quite complex platoon operations in the Dutch facility with only 24 buildings, given what they've done on the outskirts of it and that sort of thing. So when people come back and they say, "Oh, we'd love to have a Sonzoob or an Altmark in the UK," I'd say, "Well, actually, what I'd rather have is four smaller facilities like Coppell Down, but then have each one of them represent properly a different urban terrain zone. So you're not getting that sort of postage stamp representation like at Sonzoob. But likewise, you're not kind of getting lost in the noise. So like with the Altmark facility, and even we even see it on the small scale with Coppell Down, a unit rarely gets the whole of Coppell Down. You normally get a portion of it because some other unit is using another side of it. So the larger your urban training area, the more we'll just use the same sized area, but we'll get more people have access to it. So you're still not really going to get to play with the whole 550 buildings. So what I'd like to see is more facilities that are spread out so that more people can get access to them, but each one of them represents a single urban terrain zone done correctly. So if you're using like a light industrial unit, you've got that space to maneuver armored vehicles around. You've got those longer sight lines that you can engage through, but you've also got those sort of thin-skinned buildings that you could potentially have effects go through and that sort of thing. So that's what I'd like to see in terms of sort of the scale of things.
And if people can go back and listen to our Urban Warfare Christmas list, this isn't that show. Of course, in that, I think we've mentioned a few times wanting that, right? Wanting an industrial, whether it's Texas or just the United States, I do want the big. I want it big and better. I want
very American job.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. And with the amount of money we spend, I want an urban combat training center. It is the decisive battle. It is where, I don't care what we're talking about, it is the decisive battle of the campaign. And I want it. It isn't a infantry room clearing exercise. High intensity urban warfare is not an infantry fight. It is a combined arms fight. And if you don't have the training facility, no, I don't want the engineers only involved on the outskirts of the city doing a combined arms breach, mainly of wire and mines. I want some realism in a full combined arms team. Like you said, I mean, I would love to see even one true exercise training mounted and dismounted, whether that's a mobile protected firepower of an armor, which is very needed in infantry, or any mounted, dismounted, as we've talked many a times. I want it. I think it's necessary. And I think it isn't money that's stopping people. It's truly agreeing that there is a problem, even in our inventory of how we use what we have, how clean it is, how unrealistic it is. And I won't even go into, none of it's urban. Stu, just to be clear, in order to be urban, you have to have man-made features on a natural terrain. You have to have people and you have to have infrastructure to support those people. So we could argue, at Muscatatuck, because it used to be a real site, it has infrastructure, has steam tunnels, has a water pure plant, it has a prison. So could we get at least some infrastructure on some of these sites? But this is just me rambling at this point. Stu, maybe we'll revisit this in December, and I'm sure Jason will have lots of thoughts. I loved going around the world and on Western urban training facilities, what they have, don't have. And I like your optimism of what you need is not scale. What you need is a little, these functional zones. I agree with you. I think they need a shift in thinking, and we need the right leaders that agree with that. So thanks for joining me, Stu. Until the next time.
Thanks for having me, John. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts. as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.